climate change the facts? The Scientific Method and Other Heresies by Stuart W. Franks. Stuart W. Franks is the Foundation Chair of Environmental Engineering at the University of Tasmania. Perhaps the most frustrating aspect of the science of climate change is the lack of any real substance in attempts to justify the hypothesis. Often the occurrence of a drought or flood is sufficient to generate a whole range of expert speculation from those that should know better. Often the claims are couched with a disclaimer. Of course, no single event is attributable to carbon dioxide and climate change. However, this is exactly the sort of event we would expect to see. Such statements are meaningless, as these are also the sort of events that we expect to see irrespective of anthropogenic climate change. What is most dismaying is that the worst examples of speculative claims often come from the scientists themselves. Commentators from the Bureau of Meteorology and the Commonwealth Scientific and Industrial Research Organization, CSIRO, are amongst the worst for making statements that are simply incorrect. One stated, "Of course the drought has not been helped by rising temperatures, which have increased losses through evaporation." And, "It is very difficult to make a case that this is just simply a run of bad luck driven by a natural cycle, and that a return to more normal rainfall is inevitable, as some would hope." In an interview with the Sydney Morning Herald, another commentator mused that, "Perhaps we should call it our new climate." A similar line was adopted by another climatologist. "In the minds of a lot of people, the rainfall we had in the 1950s, 1960s, and 1970s was a benchmark. But we are just not going to have that sort of good rain again as long as the system is warming up." Such claims are not limited to off-the-cuff speculation in the media. Many incorrect claims surface in the scientific literature. One example was the flurry of activity attempting to link the recent Murray-Darling Basin drought and anthropogenic climate change. The Murray-Darling Basin drought was initiated by the 2002-03 El Niño. Immediately following this, a report under the auspices of the WWF Australia noted that whilst rainfall had been low, the air temperatures had been particularly elevated. This led the authors to claim that the higher temperatures caused a marked increase in evaporation rates, which sped up the loss of soil moisture and the drying of vegetation and watercourses. This is the first drought in Australia where the impact of human-induced global warming can be clearly observed. While this may sound intuitively correct, it is wrong. It completely ignores the known science of evapotranspiration and boundary layer meteorology. That is, when soil contains high moisture content, much of the sun's energy is used in evaporation, and consequently, there is limited heating of the surface. However, during drought, soil moisture content is low, and consequently, nearly all of the incoming radiation is converted into heating the surface. The result is that air temperatures rise significantly. Others went further. CSIRO researchers published a number of studies in leading international journals, which wholeheartedly adopted the flawed physics to make some spectacular claims. The researchers claimed that a 1 degree increase in temperature causes a reduction in annual water flows of 15%. The series of reports and journal articles confused cause and effect with regard to the fundamental basics of evaporation and boundary layer meteorology. Reduced evaporation causes higher air temperatures. It is drought, which is naturally associated with lower evapotranspiration, which leads to higher temperatures. Above all, there was no expertise evident in these claims. Such misunderstanding of basic physics is not confined to Australia's lead scientific research organizations. U.S. and European studies of trends in drought have also confused the role of air temperature and evaporation. These studies employed the Palmer Drought Severity Index, PDSI, which approximates evapotranspiration through a simplistic model that utilizes temperature as a proxy for the atmospheric demand for moisture. Given an increasing trend in air temperature, the studies would demonstrate an increasing trend in evaporative losses. Again, such claims were readily reported in the media. Eventually, in 2012, Sheffield et al. Identified the error in such a simplistic approach, stating, "The simplicity of the PDSI, which is calculated from a simple water balance model forced by monthly precipitation and temperature data, makes it an attractive tool in large-scale drought assessments, but may give biased results in the context of climate change. Here we show that the previously reported increase in global drought is overestimated because the PDSI uses a simplified model of potential evaporation that responds only to changes in temperature and thus responds incorrectly to global warming in recent decades. More realistic calculations, based on the underlying physical principles, that take into account changes in available energy, humidity, and wind speed, suggest that there has been little change in drought over the past 60 years. Unfortunately, the error received little, if any, attention in the media and the public, and the misconception of observed increasing drought due to anthropogenic climate change continues to be repeated in public and scientific discourse. As with all droughts, the Murray-Darling Basin drought came to an end, and, as so often in Australia, it took a flood to break the drought. Despite the speculation noted earlier that, quote, "In the minds of a lot of people, the rainfall we had in the 1950s, 1960s, and 1970s was a benchmark, but we are just not going to have that sort of good rain again as long as the system is warming up," Eastern Australia experienced rainfall all too reminiscent of the 1950s, 1960s, and 1970s. In late 2010, La Niña returned after a 9-year absence, and with it we saw flooding across Eastern Australia, the likes of which we had not seen since 1974, also a La Niña year. Whilst the floods and cyclone were devastating in their impact, again, there was nothing to suggest that their occurrence was anything but normal, given the known climatology of Eastern Australia. But once again, the experts lined up to proclaim that no doubt climate change was involved. It seems that any climate extreme represents the impact of anthropogenic climate change. Dr. Kevin Trenberth, who plays a leading role in developing the IPCC science, provided all the inspiration required in a recent paper entitled "Framing the Way to Relate Climate Extremes to Climate Change." His essential message was that to ask to what degree climate change contributed to an event was actually asking the wrong question. His way of framing the climate debate is that every event is influenced by climate change. The implication of this is that because the science cannot answer the question, it doesn't have to. Scientists should just claim everything is a sign of climate change. None too surprisingly, the Australian Climate Commission heeded this call, which was most clearly advocated in its recent Angry Summer report. It concluded that everything that happened that summer was due in part to climate change. This is the kind of science many might prefer to the real thing. A science where one doesn't actually have to do anything to justify one's claims. In reality, Trenberth's framing of the climate science debate has little to do with science. It is merely advocacy for a catastrophic future outlook. Above all, it represents an intellectually weak approach to science from those that lead it. One very unfortunate event followed just a week after the widespread floods of 2010-11. A paper was published in the journal Nature, which claimed to have linked increases in rainfall to anthropogenic climate change. This was heralded across the Australian Broadcasting Commission as a significant result. Expert commentators were sought to evaluate its meaning. To paraphrase, one climate scientist announced that, quote, "It was published in Nature, so it must be right." Another claimed that, quote, "We already knew this, so it only confirms what we already thought." Such comments could have been as easily made without even bothering to read the paper. No critical analysis was ever provided. The unfortunate timing, coming so soon after the floods, meant that inevitably many scientists were emboldened in linking our floods to increased temperatures and consequently climate change. The paper has gone on to enjoy great academic success, having been cited more than 300 times in its short period of existence. There is, however, one rather major problem with the paper. The study never did compare the calculated rainfall probabilities against the corresponding temperature. If it had, it would have noted that there was no correlation at all between the two. Figure 1 shows the 5-year average one-day rainfall probabilities from 1951 onwards. There is a spike at the end, but no substantive evidence for a consistent trend. The gray line shows northern hemisphere temperature anomalies for the same periods. Note that between 1951 and 1975, temperature anomalies were declining, whilst half of the apparent increase in rainfall occurred. A more appropriate conclusion of the paper could have been that, 1, rainfall intensities are highly variable in time, and 2, temperature appears not to significantly influence the risk of intense rainfalls. The paper would not have been published in Nature, nor would it have received any of the attention that it got, and still gets. The reality is that climate is hugely complicated and highly variable, and that it is actually meaningless to attempt to identify anthropogenic climate change through climate events like floods or droughts. So if this is the case, how does one test climate change? The key to testing claims of catastrophic anthropogenic climate change lies in the simplicity of the mechanism itself. Atmospheric carbon dioxide concentrations are rising, carbon dioxide is a greenhouse gas, and it absorbs and re-radiates long-wave radiation downwards. The radiation is trapped, or at least delayed, meaning that there is more of it around, and hence temperatures go up. So the simplest way to test the hypothesis is to measure the planet's energy balance, in particular downward long-wave radiation. In search of the signal of climate change, a recent NASA study has attempted to do just this. The method itself is rather complex, involving multiple satellite remote sensing platforms, radiative modeling, and a whole raft of assumptions and uncertainties. That said, the results are viewed as the most meaningful way to estimate the role and context of CO2 in the atmosphere. Figure 2 shows the estimated global fluxes of the surface energy balance. The 24-year record of long-wave radiation is shown in the middle graph. What is immediately apparent is that there are large year-to-year variations. Major positive variations are linked to particularly strong El Niño events. Underlying this variability, one can perceive a relatively minor general increase in long-wave flux. However, it is small relative to the naturally occurring variability within the series. It is worthwhile to note at this point that atmospheric carbon dioxide rose by approximately 25% over this period. The long-wave response to this, the actual mechanism of climate change, appears rather muted, if not entirely underwhelming. Of even greater significance is the shortwave radiation. This is the amount of solar radiation, sunshine, received at the surface, and so is primarily influenced by global cloudiness, but also dust and aerosols. Note the 2 to 3 year decline in shortwave following the 1991 eruption of Mount Pinatubo. There are a number of aspects of Figure 2 that are of importance to note. First of all, the variability in the incoming shortwave is much greater than the variability in the long wave. In fact, it is approximately twice as large. Consequently, the shortwave variability is clearly more important to the overall energy balance. Also important to note is the decadal timescales of variability. In particular, there appears to have been a substantial declining trend since around 2000. Finally, the shortwave variability shows no apparent correlation with the longwave variability. Consequently, changes in longwave radiation do not appear to have any influence on global cloudiness, which has a larger influence on the overall energy balance on decadal timescales. In Figure 2, the global net radiation anomalies are shown in the bottom graph, in comparison to the global temperature record shown in the top graph. The net imbalance appears to have been negative since 2000, during which time global temperatures have not risen. This then begs the question, what does cause these variations in the Earth's energy balance? There have been a range of explanations offered to explain away this recent hiatus in temperatures, as well as the previous hiatus that occurred between 1945 and 1975. In the first instance, many climate scientists have simply refused to accept that these periods exist in anything other than a random statistical sense. Natural year-to-year variability gives statistical anomalies over short periods. Others have suggested that it is global emissions of aerosols, which have a net cooling effect, ironically, especially those emitted from burning coal. In this narrative, the 1945 to 1975 cooling was caused by the post-war boom, whilst the most recent hiatus is due to the recent rise of Chinese coal burning. More recently, the favored narrative is that the global temperature has been relatively static, because the additional heat is being trapped in the oceans instead. A recent paper, again published in Nature, suggested that this was in large part due to a natural multi-decadal variability, termed the Pacific Decadal Oscillation, PDO, or the Interdecadal Pacific Oscillation, IPO, and associated with El Niño and La Niña behavior. The narrative is that natural processes mean that the extra heat goes into the oceans, but that at some time soon, the heat will return with a vengeance. There are a number of problems with these claims. Importantly, the trapping of the heat is inferred from models, not from observations. The NASA data seems to suggest that it is not excess energy being trapped in the ocean, but rather that the change in the IPO-PDO has led to increased cloudiness, hence a reduction in the incoming shortwave radiation around the year 2000, as seen in Figure 3. This would mean that there is no excess to be trapped, whether in the ocean or anywhere else. Not surprisingly, the recent study did not consider, let alone evaluate this. Perhaps the greatest problem with this recent result is that in many ways it is not recent at all. The climate community has known about this mode of climate variability since the late 1990s. Since 2000, I myself, amongst others, have published extensively on the IPO-PDO and its strong links to multi-decadal flood and drought risk in Australia, i.e., the rainfall we had in the 1950s, 1960s, and 1970s. The papers also noted its links to variable periods of global warming and cooling, pointing out that the climate models could not simulate it and that perhaps we could expect a return to a cooling period at some point in the near future. Little did we know that in 2000 it had already begun. This is the kind of science I prefer, one which develops an insight and makes a prediction which can be evaluated in terms of what subsequently occurs. The majority of climate scientists, blindly relying on climate models, fail in their predictions. They adapt to this by explaining why the reality is different from the models. Theirs is not science, but the continual rewriting of a narrative and always after the event. There is always a story to explain why their models fail, but also why we should all expect catastrophic climate change nonetheless. Karl Popper, the great philosopher of science, observed and defined this quite clearly. A theory has to be tested. He called this falsification. This requires making a prediction and then testing it. Rather than rejecting a failed theory, scientists might adapt their theory to include the anomaly in the testing. This he called fortification. If the theory fails, adapt it. Fortify it until it fits. The problem with fortification is that you cannot keep doing it forever. Eventually, there are too many patches and band-aids to support it. The most important thing to note is that this lack of warming was not predicted by climate models. This is because climate models are built, predicated on the assumption that increased CO2 leads to increased water vapor, and together, through a positive feedback loop, lead to runaway global warming because of a runaway increase in downward longwave radiation. The NASA energy balance data appear to lead us to reject this hypothesis. The temperature data themselves lead us to reject climate models as accurate simulators of the global climate. Instead, climate scientists speculate about flood and droughts mostly in ignorance. They also speculate about everything else that could be impacted by climate. The fervor with which some speculate following natural climate disasters is in stark contrast to the ability to attribute these events to atmospheric CO2 concentrations. In their frustration, many now claim all events are influenced. We just don't know by how much. A more scientific approach is to directly test the hypothesis by directly measuring the proposed mechanism, specifically the energy balance of the planet. The results to date, whilst only suggestive, do point to a much more conservative role of CO2 in influencing the energy balance than the climate models predict. Consequently, predictions of catastrophic climate change, above and beyond natural catastrophic climate variability, seem somewhat premature, if not grossly exaggerated. Above all, there is no insight gained by speculating on individual floods, droughts, or even their short-term trends. I do recall one study some years back that claimed that a species of chicken was becoming smaller as local temperatures rose. One author of the study ruefully commented to the media, quote, "If climate change continues like this, then one day you'll be able to fit them in your pocket." I assume that at least the scientists could see the absurdity of such speculation. Climate Change: The Facts is published by Stockade Books. All rights reserved.